now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
We Americans are pretty short-sighted. We don't really pay much attention to what's going on outside of our little sandbox here. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest brings the insight of somebody who was raised in the United States but has lived for four decades in Israel and is married to a woman who speaks Arabic, and so she can understand what is being said in the nations around Israel. The gentleman is an author of numerous books and always in demand as a speaker at workshops and conferences. And in fact, he'll be one of the featured speakers at the upcoming Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference in mid-July, co-sponsored by Skywatch TV and our friends at Prophecy Watchers. We welcome to the program for the first time Avi Lipkin.
A couple of books here that you brought with you. Islam Prophesied in Genesis and Return to Mecca. And some. This is intriguing. Now, I understand Islam Prophesied in Genesis got you in trouble in Switzerland.
Right.
Now,
well, what happened was that, you know, I've been speaking in churches 26 years. So not only do I speak, I actually attend, and I listen to the preachings of the pastors. And I hear things that most Jewish people never hear. And I think about it, you know, you put the morsel in your mouth and you taste it and you think, yeah, makes sense, you know. And pastors teach the same Bible as the Jews have, and but the pastors have a slightly different approach. And I look at what we know from the Bible, and I see things that the rabbis don't talk about. And once I had a 1.5 hour meeting with a very, very ultra-Orthodox rabbi in the town where I live. And I said to him, where's Mount Sinai? And he said, we don't know. Now, Helena, mother of Constantine, decided that this is in the Egyptian peninsula of Sinai. But that's a mistake, because the Egyptian army was there. The Israelites could not have been there. And Jim and Penny Caldwell came out with their video, and I met them 5-6 years ago, and they prove that the real Mount Sinai is in northwest Saudi. So I started thinking about it. I started checking into the Torah, and I found words that the rabbis completely overlook. And, you know, there's this animosity between Judaism and Christianity, but the fact is that the rabbis go by the King James, and the King James translation is wrong. And so, for example, you know, when Moses says to Pharaoh, let my people go, so that they may go around in circles in the desert, that's, and it says Hajj. It says Hag in Hebrew.
Really?
But Hag is Hajj. Hajj is the pilgrimage.
Yes.
And so I said to the rabbis, you know, guess what? 40 years in the desert, we were in Arabia. I asked them, where were we? So what happens is, little by little, you start putting together a picture, and you see the antithesis of Judeo-Christianity. And I get into a lot of trouble with the Jewish people in Israel when I say that, you know, Jews and Christians are one people. The Muslims also say it. That the Jews are the Saturday people, Christians are the Sunday people, so kill the Jew on Saturday, kill the Christian on Sunday. But the point is that Mount Sinai, where the Torah was given, not only to the Jews, but the Christians, because Christians believe in the Torah also. So this is a God-given gift from Mount Sinai. So if Mount Sinai is not in the Egyptian peninsula of Sinai, where is it? It's in northwest Saudi Arabia. So I started writing my yellow book about Mecca and Medina. And but before I went into the yellow book number 6, I said, you know what, we've got to do a book about Genesis first. Because Genesis shows that Allah, the God of Islam, Allah, the moon god, the war god, the sword god, is Satan. Satan, Lucifer, the devil. And when I went to Switzerland, I was invited to help the Swiss people. They were having a referendum about whether or not to allow the Muslims to build minarets so that they could proclaim 5 times a day with loudspeakers at 4:30 in the morning, Allah Akbar, and you hear this for miles. And so I went to 23 German-speaking cities in Switzerland, and on November the 29th, 2009, and you can look it up in Google or YouTube, all these things, the Swiss people voted down the minarets, praise God. So I played a role in that. And I said to them, you know, if you allow them to proclaim Allahu Akbar, which means Allah is greater, who said he was greater than God before his fall from heaven? Satan. So yeah. Allah is Satan. They call their God the greatest of all the liars and deceivers. Al-Makr in mm-hmm. Arabic. Mm-hmm. Al-Makr means Allah is the greatest of the liars and deceivers. Hmm. Who's their forefather? Ishmael, who was rejected of God.
Right.
Because God chose Isaac.
The son of the promise was Isaac, right.
So what I do is I go through the entire book of Genesis, and I have to blame Chuck Missler, because Chuck Missler is also kind of my rabbi. And the way he teaches, I try to emulate it, but from a Jewish perspective. And I always say that Jews and Christians are like the right hand and the left hand, but together we clap. And I'm very pleased to be here and work with Christian groups. And I wish the Jewish groups in Israel would listen to me like the Christians do.
Well, it's fascinating. One of the things I've been reading about lately is about the holy mountain, and the concept of the holy mountain of God.
Right.
Of course, Sinai was where
Correct.
Moses received the law.
Correct.
We also know that there was Mount Hermon where the watchers came down. There was also a mount in the north of Syria,
right.
Called Mount Acra today, but it was back in the day called Mount Zaphon, mm-hmm. where Baal was supposed to have his palace.
Right.
Yahweh told Moses, before they crossed the Red Sea, turn around. I want you to turn around, and you're going to cross opposite Baal Zaphon.
Yeah.
I had no idea why Baal, a Canaanite god, was being worshipped in Egypt. History. The Hyksos kings, who came from Canaan and dominated Egypt for several hundred years while the Israelites were there, were worshippers of Baal, or Set in the Egyptian pantheon, the god of chaos. When Jesus was accused of driving out demons by the power of Beelzebul, Baal the prince, Jesus responded, if Satan should drive out, he equated Baal with Satan. So Allah equals Baal equals Set equals
correct.
Satan.
Absolutely correct.
It's been a long war, and they've been fighting over the Holy Land, the lands of the Bible. But this, in your second book now, Return to Mecca, you talk about how there will be conflict within the house of Islam over
correct.
Their holy sites, and how ultimately, do I understand correctly, the
yes.
Jewish people, the Jewish nation will wind up with their holy sites?
Okay, now, this is a revolutionary idea mm-hmm. that our rabbis in Israel, and I love my rabbis, but they're inside of a box. They do not think about that. And, you know, you ask the rabbis, where's the real Mount Sinai? We don't know. It's not in the Talmud, so if it's not in the Talmud, we don't discuss it. And what I do is I read the Bible. We have a word in Hebrew, pshat. Pshat means you read it word for word, and you analyze each word, and you don't rely on something that rabbis said 1,000 years ago or 1,500 years ago, especially because those rabbis did not know geography.
Hmm.
And they did not know Islam. And even today, you know, I go to synagogue, and very often, you know, people in the synagogue say, okay, Avi, talk a little bit about what you do. And, you know, and they don't want to hear, you know, the moment I say Christians, stop. We don't want to hear Christians. We don't want to hear New Testament. Islam, stop. We don't want to hear about Allah and Muhammad. Only to, I said, but guys, you know, you gotta know all the different cultures. You got to know them, because the Christians are our brothers and sisters and our allies. And the Muslims, they're good people, but they're the enemy. Because their God is, their God wants to kill the Jews on Saturday and Christians on Sunday. So, you know, how could that be God? You know, I learned from the Christians something Jews don't even know, which is Zechariah 2, verse 12. Zechariah 2, verse 12 says that the Jews are the apple of God's eye. And anyone who touches the Jews touches the apple of God's eye. You don't want to touch the apple of God's eye mm-hmm. because you'll pay for it. So then I get into trouble. I quote Romans 9 to 11, and I say that the Christians are grafted into the apple of God's eye, which makes you guys also the apple of God's eye. So anyone who touches, listen, the olive tree has roots and branches. Jews are the roots, Christians mm-hmm. are the branches. No tree can survive with only branches or with only roots.
Right.
So the Jews and the Christians are together. And, you know, I'm forming a Judeo-Christian party in Jerusalem,
mm-hmm. yes.
which will be registered, God willing, April 21st. So I'm very excited about that, too, bringing the Jews and Christians together. And I'm predicting ISIS is going to cause a mass migration of Jews and Christians from all over the world to Israel.
Mm. Well, we'll talk about the political party in our next program, because
right.
I want to talk about the political situation in Israel and
right.
also the influence that the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox communities have.
Right.
That's something I don't know anything about. But I know that the Saudi kingdom is very nervous about ISIS. A year ago, December, they began building a 600-mile-long high-tech border fence between Saudi Arabia and Anbar province of Iraq, which is where ISIS is dominant, because they are concerned about ISIS coming across the border.
It won't help them. Because 92% of the Saudis support ISIS.
Hmm.
ISIS is already in the kingdom.
Hmm.
Jordan, 80% of the Jordanians support ISIS. There are Bedouin tribes that have already signed agreements with ISIS. When something big happens, they go over to ISIS. You're going to have black flags of ISIS on the Jordan River. Now you tell me, is Israel going to just sit back and watch? They're going to be digging tunnels under the Jordan River so that millions of volunteer Muslim terrorists can come across and destroy Israel. Mm-hmm. This is their dream. This is their obsession.
Hmm.
So what I'm saying is I predict ISIS will eventually overturn Jordan, will eventually overturn Saudi Arabia. Fence, no fence. It doesn't matter. There in Israel, in Jerusalem, I visited some very dear Christian friends in the high part of the old city, and we went. They had a roof apartment. We went up to the roof. We looked out. We saw black flags over the old city of Jerusalem.
Oh, wow.
They're inside Jerusalem. They're also in the Galilee, which is not Palestinian territories. They're just regular Israeli Muslims. They're ISIS.
Hmm. So the threat to the Islamic State or the threat to the Saudi kingdom is that ISIS wants the credibility of controlling their holy sites?
It's not only controlling. There are three primary things that ISIS wants to do in Saudi Arabia. They want to kill the king and his family because the king and the family go off to drinking, gambling, and prostitution,
right.
Which is how can they be the guardians of the holy places? Secondly, they have 19 million people in Saudi Arabia, but they also have 1 million Hindus from India as slaves,
mm-hmm.
and 1 million Catholics from Philippines. So ISIS says, get rid of them or we will behead all 2 million and we will behead the whole Saudi family. They're very serious about this. They want to blow up the oil wells because the reason Christianity, in their opinion, rules over the world, and for them, Christianity is also China, India, Japan, which are not Christian.
Right.
But, you know, the one world government economy is because Saudi Arabia plays ball with the one world economy, provides the oil, gets the money, and then reinvests the money in what I call the takeover.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Saudi king has a plan peacefully to take over the West. ISIS says, no. The West has to be simply destroyed, all the Christians and Jews killed. And they're very serious about it. And finally, the Black Stone, the Kaaba, mm-hmm. in the center of Mecca, has to be destroyed, according to ISIS, because Muhammad had no right to incorporate that pagan abomination stone.
Uh-huh.
And they did horrible things there. In other words, you remember the story in the Bible of Phineas,
mm-hmm.
where he skewers Zimri and Cozbi in the middle of a sexual act, the Israelite
right.
prince and the Midianite princess. There was something called temple prostitution. And
yes.
Acts 15 and Acts 21 is called fornication.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Peter and James say to the new believers, avoids eating meat offered to idols and fornication.
Right.
So fornication is with temple prostitutes. All the religions around at that time had sex.
Right. They were defiling the tabernacle.
Right.
It's not exactly explicit in the text, but they were Phineas was basically, they were right there in the entrance to the temple, the tent.
And not only that, they offered their children on the altar of Molech,
right,
Baal,
right.
at the Black Stone. They had homosexual relations. They had bestiality, which is sleeping with animals. All these things that God says are an abomination,
right.
and he hates them, we're all at the stone. So ISIS says that stone has to be destroyed.
Hmm.
Now, the crazy thing is, when ISIS destroys the Kaaba, that's the end of Islam.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are looking at some crazy things happening right now. Eventually, God is turning the Muslims against each other, which we see in the Bible in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, when three armies march against Jerusalem, you know, Ammon, Moab, and Seir, and then they turn on each other and kill each other. So God has the solutions.
Hmm. One of the things that I think, you know, we Americans, and you've got a perspective of this, born and raised here in the United States, but lived most of your life in Israel.
Right.
So you've got a perspective looking in from the outside at our culture,
correct.
As well as being one who's in it, so you can understand it to some extent. We are very narrow in our focus. If it's not happening here in the U.S., if it's not Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, we don't care.
Right.
We don't have much of an understanding of the Islamic world. I'm guilty of this. It's only recently I really began to understand the differences between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam, and that there are divisions within those there's subdivisions within those divisions that
yes.
are not in agreement with one another.
Right.
The civil war in Syria, is it just as simple as a civil war within the religion, the Shias versus the Sunnis?
Okay, well, of course, you have a coalition with Bashar al-Assad, which includes Christians, Druze. Druze are a group descended from Jethro.
Mm-hmm.
They're there. They're in Israel, they're Jordan, they're in Lebanon.
So Moses' father-in-law, they believe Jethro was their progenitor.
Absolutely. And they used to be Muslims, and then about 1,000 years ago, they were declared heretics because the Druze said that Muhammad was not the greatest and latest, but Jethro was. So they were persecuted and killed, and they fled to the mountains of Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. And so they're a minority in Syria. So the Christians, the Druze, the Shiites are also a minority. They're only 10% in Syria. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Kurds in the northeast who actually want autonomy or independence. You have Yazidis. You have all these different very historic groups going back 2,000 years or more. The rebels, quote-unquote, in Syria, ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda, these are Sunnis. So basically, the population in Syria is 50-50. In other words, 50% Sunnis, 50% minorities, plus some Sunnis who were part of the Ba'ath Party and are in the highest levels of Bashar al-Assad's government.
Okay.
I'm changing the subject a little, but for example, Germany has taken in 1 million Syrians because the Syrians are very well educated. Under the Ba'ath regime of Bashar al-Assad, Hafez al-Assad, these people learn many, many trades. So, of course, you have some people who are illiterate, but the Syrian, the element known as the Syrian people, theoretically could be good for a German economy.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is if ISIS sends in 4,000 vanguard terrorists with the refugees, they can overturn Germany or Italy or Rome.
Right.
They even said, you know, these Italians who are picking us up from Libya, as soon as we enter international waters, we are sending our vanguard. We're going to blow up the Vatican, kill the Pope, and take Rome.
Right.
Something they've been dreaming to do for years. I would say, look at Rome. Look at Rome. I think Rome is the next target because Europeans don't have a clue.
Well, and that's the subject of the new book coming out by Tom Horn and Chris Putnam here in just a few weeks.
Right.
That's exactly what they're writing about.
Yeah.
There are also, you know, divisions within the nation of Israel. And this is something, again, we Americans, we're so focused on our own political games, and we barely understand our own political process, much less the political process inside Israel.
Right.
Here in the United States, we're so used to having just two political parties. It's Democrat, it's Republican. Of course, that drives the Libertarians and the Greens and the Constitution Party people crazy.
Right.
But it's a rigged game, essentially.
Right.
In Israel, there are considerably more political parties.
Right.
You've been working on developing a new political party. Can you give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch of what is the political situation in Israel and how is the person on the street viewing the situation in Syria? You know, what are the concerns that people there have about things spilling over into Israel?
Well, you know, the first thing I have to say is that I always say in the churches that Israel... Israel was like a flower in the middle of the desert. Now Israel is like a flower in the middle of a forest fire. And God has his hand on Israel, and he's protecting us, and these countries are all destroying each other. And God says in Exodus, I will fight for you, and you will be still.
Mm.
Be silent, and I will fight for you. And until now, Israel has been very fortunate not to get involved in these wars which are surrounding us. And actually, Israel has been strengthening the king of Jordan and strengthening the president of Egypt. What I wanted to share, by the way, this is my fourth book, and it's called Israel's Bible Block.
Yes.
And it talks about the party, which I'm registering on the 21st of April.
Mm.
I'm submitting it. It takes the Israeli government 6 weeks to review the signatures that they're all alive. You know, like not like in America, where maybe 115% of a county votes for Clinton.
Yeah, I know. I grew up in Chicago,
Obama,
and I was 35 years old before I realized that vote early, vote often was not actual advice from the Cook County Board of Election Commissioners. So
yes.
I understand.
And also from the morgue.
Yeah, yes, yeah. We don't discriminate, alive, dead.
But this talks about the history of modern Israel in the last 100 years, and it explains why the situation today is ripe for a Judeo-Christian political party. And there will be many rabbis who are going to be very upset with what I'm doing. But the point is this. We, Jews and Christians, agree that the Messiah is a Jew from Israel who speaks Hebrew.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay? So for the Christians, it's Jesus Christ. For the Jews, Jews don't know. This Messiah, according to the Jewish definition of the Messiah, has to come not only for one group. He has to come for all the peoples of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what is happening is that the Muslims want to kill the Jews on Saturday, Christians on Sunday. If you have 6 million Jews in America and 80% are intermarried with Christians in America, which is the true statistic. Hmm. So we're talking about 6 million Jews and perhaps 3, 4 million Christians, that both groups, husbands and wives, are going to be killed by ISIS and the children of the intermarriage. Kids can go to church on Sunday. They're not really Jewish, but if the father is Jewish or the mother is Jewish, they will all be killed.
Right.
It's like the Nazis. And so Israel's population today is 6 million Jews, 500,000 Christians, and 1.5 million Muslims. Now, the Jews in Israel, we have very, very few what I call white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Jews.
Yeah.
What we have are Jews who came from the Islamic countries. For example, my wife, Rachel, half the population comes from Islamic countries. Half the population comes from former Soviet socialist bloc. We don't have what Alexis de Tocqueville called, you know, the great American democracy mm-hmm. in Israel. We have 33 political parties. Israel is a proportional representation system. So, for example, we have four primary blocs. We have, for example, socialist mm-hmm. And left liberals. For me, liberal is an anomaly. It's not oxymoron. Liberals, the extreme leftists are liberals with a capital L. You know, but the word liberal with a small L, mm-hmm. these are people who really will listen. The liberals with the capital L, they won't listen. They're right. Soviet socialists. We have fanatic Muslim parties. We have very ultra-Orthodox rabbinic parties. Mm-hmm. Some of them are Hasidic. Some of them are just simply Torah parties. And then we have the Likud and Israel Beiteinu and a few other parties which are, they are populist nationalist parties. And the prime minister, whoever he may be, has to put together a government based on 61 members of Knesset, at least, out of the 120.
So he's got to pick and make deals with some of the smaller parties in addition to his party in order to reach that number.
Everything is horse trading. This is like haggling in the market.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like here in America where you have a president, you might like him, you might hate him, but he's there for 8 years, you know, or 4 years.
Yeah.
And nothing you can do about it. And, you know, I have to tell you, I keep hearing about, we're going to impeach Obama. Oh, we're going to impeach Clinton. Oh, we're going to... And in Israel, all the prime minister needs is that one member of Knesset get angry with him, the whole government collapses. Because he loses, right now it's 61, but there are three guys who are troublemakers. And they're saying, if we don't get what we want, it's extortion.
Yeah.
If we don't get what we want, we're going to bring down the government.
Now, I've been reading that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been trying to negotiate with Herzog of a different party. But now Herzog is under investigation for some malfeasance. And
Everyone is under investigation. You know what? I don't want to say this, but, you know, every country gets its political leaders because of tax evasion or something in taxes. Al Capone because he didn't pay his taxes.
Right, right.
We have another case of a minister who sat in jail already 7 years. He was the interior minister. Finally got out of jail, waited another 7 years to clear his name, and he's now the interior minister again.
Huh.
So now they caught him. They said, you have a house in the Galilee worth $2 million. Where did you get the money for this? He never declared it. So he's going back to jail again. Israel's a very challenging place to do politics.
Well, again, you know, I'm from Illinois, from Chicago. Yeah. Illinois has got the best prison food in the country because we've got so many former governors who are living there now.
Hey, listen, we got a president and a prime minister, and we got rabbis in our jails.
That's it.
We got everything.
Well, let me ask you about this, because this is something that I've been curious about. Over the last few months, we've seen a stream of reports from Israel of Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox rabbis who are publicly declaring that Messiah is his appearance is imminent. And, you know, here in the United States, we've got a lot of people who are solid Bible believers, but the dominant culture is not. Most people who call themselves born-again Christians really don't have as firm a grasp of Bible as that term implies. How much influence, and so when somebody like Franklin Graham says, you know, this is what we believe, that doesn't carry a lot of weight with the majority of the American populace. How much influence do the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox rabbis have with the average people in Israel? I mean, do most people believe that we are in the end times and that the Messiah is about to arrive?
Well, in my fourth book about the political party, I give a history of the renewed Jewish population in the land of Israel. The land was empty for many years. The Jews were always there, but small groups. And what has happened is that the from 1922, more or less, until 1948, Israel was rock solid control of the socialists. And the rabbis, there were very few rabbis because Hitler killed many of the rabbis in the Holocaust. And so Ben-Gurion, who was a socialist and he was not religious, he wanted the votes of the religious to support him.
Sure.
He said, we will give you money, build your yeshivas, you know, rejuvenate the Torah studying population. We will give you we'll give you exemption from the army. At that time, it was 500 students. Today, it's 50,000 students are exempt from the army because they're studying yeshivas. So what has happened is that the growth or the resurgence of the ultra-Orthodox and the Hasidim and other groups in Israel, all great people, but they all have a viewpoint which is not really very much interested in what's going on in the world or outside of the box or with Islam or Christianity. These rabbis focus only on the Judaic studies and the Talmud and the Torah and everything like this. Now, what has happened is also, and if you look up in the computer the word Knesset, Knesset actually is the same word as the Greek ekklesia, which is the church.
Yeah.
So we say, for example, church in Hebrew, we say kinesia. The N and the L switch. So kinesia is ekklesia. It's the same word. The Christians in Israel have been 2% for 2,000 years. In 1989, 1990, all of a sudden, 1 million people come home from the former Soviet Union. 30% of them are Christian. So they go to the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
So now the Christians in Israel are 8%. We have many other groups in Israel. So, but the point I'm saying is Israel today, I would say 50% of the Jewish population, or 50, maybe 55% of the population is traditional or religious. 20-30% are socialists, don't believe in anything, and about 20% are ultra-Orthodox. So, you know, but if you look at the Knesset, that's what I was going to say. If you look at the Knesset in the computer, look it up in Google, and you look through the 20 elections over the last 70 years, you're going to see that the right-wing and religious parties are increasing. And the socialists, who were almost the majority in 1948, the socialists are decreasing. They're less and less. Every election, they're going down. They don't marry. They don't have children. Many of them leave the country because if you're not a religious person, you leave the country. Israel's a very hard country to live in. People go to America. They go to Britain like any other people. So what happens is that the trend in Israel is more and more towards the tradition, and more people are talking about the Messiah now.
That's very interesting. Kind of the opposite of what's happening here in the United States.
Right. Israel's becoming more religious and more conservative all the time. And my party will be religious and conservative for religious and conservative Jews and religious and conservative Christians.
That'll be really interesting to see how that works together.
Yeah. Yes.
Avi Lipkin's website is vicmord.com. You'll see that on your screen, vicmord.com, if you'd like to buy his books or DVDs. And again, he will be one of the featured speakers at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference coming up in mid-July. That is sold out, but the live stream is available, so you can watch it live. All 32 speakers will be featured at least once, and all of those videos will be archived for 6 weeks after the event. If you want information on subscribing to the live stream for the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, log on to the website of our friends at Prophecy Watchers. That's prophecywatchers.com.
Now, because you're paying attention, you no doubt noticed that I said you can see the link on your screen. This is because I happened to snag Avi while he was coming through the Ozarks on his way from Kansas City to Springfield, which is not a direct route, but thankfully Avi was kind enough to detour and swing by our studios at Skywatch TV. You'll also see a couple of daily updates with him and probably a web-only exclusive 30-minute interview with Avi. So we got him for three sessions, and you'll see two of those this week as daily updates on Skywatch TV. The third one probably going to our YouTube channel. We are working on getting a Roku-only channel set up on the Skywatch TV channel on Roku, and that is where you'll probably see that. Sadly, because we have so many projects in the pipeline at Skywatch TV, which is exciting, it doesn't leave us a whole lot of room for guests from outside coming in. Just to give you an idea of a couple of things coming up, there's a new book that Tom is publishing that features
many of the people that you have seen on Skywatch TV are directly affiliated with Skywatch TV or are part of the milieu in which we operate. It's an anthology called I Predict, in which Tom asked a dozen people to take a topic and speculate about what we might see in that particular area over the next 10 years. Some of the people included in this anthology are yours truly, my best friend and wife, the one around the office who's usually just referred to as the smart one. Sharon has a chapter in there, Tom Horn, of course, but also folks like Josh Tolley writing about economics, Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis, Josh Peck. So a number of other folks who have contributed to this as well. And that book will be released in just a couple of weeks. So that's one project. Then, of course, we've got updates about what's happening out at Whispering Ponies Ranch. Things are coming together nicely there. So that will be featured on an upcoming episode. Of course, Nita Horn's biography, which is very inspiring. Sharon went through multiple Kleenexes in reading the biography. And that is coming out in just a couple of weeks. The official release date on her biography, April 19th. And April 19th, file that date in your memory because we're going to talk about that date here in just a couple of minutes. There are other projects coming up. Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis has a new book that Tom is publishing later this year. I'm working on a book that he's supposed to publish later this year. Of course, there's going to be multiple weeks devoted to the forthcoming book from Tom and Chris Putnam called The Last Roman Emperor, The Islamic Antichrist, and The Final Crusade. It basically is the fourth book in the series that follows On the Path of the Immortals, Exo Vaticana, and Petrus Romanus. And you'll begin seeing those programs in the month of May. So bottom line is, we didn't have a whole lot of time in the schedule, like all the way through December. But with Avi Lipkin in town, we had to grab him, get him in the studio, and get his opinion on some things anyway. So we'll be making those available, like I said, through our Roku channel at Skywatch TV. And you are actually getting a preview here of the two daily updates. I just kind of jammed the audio together and to create a program. He was on limited schedule. He got to our place at about 2:30. He had to be up in Springfield by 5. That's almost an hour drive. So like I said, we just had to basically sit down and start the cameras. A couple of things I wanted to talk about. And there's something here that has been getting a lot of attention. We've been, many of you have been very kind to send links to articles about this. And this is the story of the recreation of the gate from the Temple of Bel. Bel is, or Temple of Baal, or Baal, in Palmyra, Syria. This is a temple that was dedicated in the year 32, AD 32, which was about the time Jesus was going to the cross. Now, who was Baal? Baal is a Canaanite god who was the principal adversary to Yahweh throughout most of the Old Testament, but even into the New Testament. And that the link between Baal, and I know that's not the proper pronunciation, but that's what most of us use, so I'll use that just for familiarity's sake. It should be Baal. But anyway, Baal was equated with Satan by Jesus himself. When Jesus was accused of casting out demons in the name of Beelzebul, which is Baal the prince, Jesus replied that Satan would not, you know, cast out demons in his own name because a house divided against itself cannot stand. So Jesus linking Satan to Baal, equating them as essentially the same person or entity rather. When you go back in history to Moses and the Exodus, earlier this year on our Gilbert House Fellowship, actually last year, Sharon and I were going through that period of that section of the book of Exodus and stumbled onto something I'd never noticed before. And I've never heard a pastor preach on when talking about the Exodus. And that was that before they crossed the Red Sea, God commanded Moses to turn back. Okay, you've got hundreds of thousands of Israelites fleeing Egypt, the Pharaoh changing his mind and sending the cavalry out after them, the most feared military in the ancient Near East, the chariots crossing the desert, chasing the Israelites, raising a cloud of dust that the Israelites can see off in the distance. And then the word comes from the front of the column. Moses says we got to turn around. What? Yeah, says Yahweh gave him a message. We got to turn around. We got to go back. Toward the Egyptians. Yes, toward the Egyptians. Now just imagine you're the poor schlub at the end of the line and you get that message. Yeah, anyway, they turned around because Yahweh wanted them to cross at a place called Pi Hahiroth opposite Baal Zephon. And so when I dug into that, I found something I'd never known before. And if you know this, and I'm repeating old news, forgive me, but I just think this is fascinating. Baal Zephon was Lord of the North. Well, there was a Mount Zephon in what is now northern Syria. It is now Jebel Akra, or Mount Akra, in northern Syria, near the town of Antioch. It's near the coast of the Mediterranean, very close to the Turkish border. That was known in the ancient world as the location of the palace of Baal. That's where Baal's holy mountain was, his cosmic mountain. And I was puzzled, why would Baal be worshipped in Egypt? Well, I guess he was really well known across the ancient Near East, and even the Egyptians took him into their pantheon. Well, no, not exactly. I had forgotten that during the period of time when the Israelites were in Egypt, Egypt was under the control of foreign rulers called the Hyksos. This is the second intermediate period. The period, a period between home rule, if you will. I mean, there were still Egyptian kings, but they were ruling in Upper Egypt, which was southern Egypt, closer to Ethiopia or Kush back in the day. Whereas these foreign rulers, the Hyksos, were ruling Lower Egypt, which is closer to the Mediterranean, the Nile Delta. And they were Baal worshippers. Not only that, but the most powerful of the Hyksos kings, pharaohs, whose name was Apophis, was a monotheist. He worshipped only Baal. Although in their culture, they equated Baal with Set. Now, Set was the chaos god in Egyptian, or rather in the Greek pantheon, equated with Typhon, which would be equated with Tiamat, the ancient primordial chaos dragon, Leviathan, if you will. So you've got this link to this old dragon prophesied to come again. In Sumerian myth, by the way, Tiamat was a seven-headed dragon. And we know that there is a seven-headed dragon that appears again in the book of Revelation in the future. You're beginning to see the connections. So Baal was the god of the Hyksos pharaohs. And would have been the god of the Hyksos pharaoh, most likely, chasing after the Israelites. And so Yahweh tells the Israelites, turn around, cross at this place that is sacred to Baal, who is supposed to be the god of maritime navigation, the god of storms. And so at a site sacred to Baal, and then crossing a medium, water, the ocean, the sea, that was supposed to be Baal's jurisdiction, Yahweh totally shows him up. Isn't that amazing? Well, so now fast forward 3,500 years, if you will, and we find that the Islamic State destroys the Temple of Baal in Palmyra, Syria, but because of photographs that have been taken of the archway, the gateway, to this temple, a group called the Institute for Digital Archaeology on April 19th is going to raise a reconstruction of this arch in Trafalgar Square, London. They're recreating this with big 3D printers using basically coal dust, rock dust, and rubber cement or something. They're 3D printing a replica of this giant gate from the Temple of Baal, in Palmyra. Now, eventually, they're going to put one of these up in London, one of these in New York, in Times Square. This, by the way, being done in conjunction with World Heritage Week, so the story goes. And according to the articles that I've read, it's supposed to be a gesture of defiance to the Islamic State for destroying this. The funny thing, of course, is that just like the Islamic State, setting up a gate to the Temple of Baal, Satan, Set, is doing the same thing as the Islamic State, which is spreading the doctrines of demons. But Sharon picked up on something that I had not noticed before. Again, the stories we've read, Times Square, Trafalgar Square, setting up these gates, replicas of the gates. And by the way, there have been stories out there in Christian media saying they're setting up the Temple of Baal. No, it's not the temple. It's a replica of the gate. I mean, that's bad enough, but let's not exaggerate. Let's not get sensational here. But Sharon noticed something that I was not aware of, that London and New York are already linked by a matching pair of ancient Egyptian obelisks called the Needles of Cleopatra. These obelisks date back about 3,500 years, not long after the Israelites fled Egypt, by the way. This would have been Thutmose III, the pharaoh who had these erected in the city of Heliopolis. They're an identical pair. And of course, when we in the West came into Egypt in the 19th century, we decided that for safekeeping, we had to take all of their stuff and take it to New York and London. So there's one in London, one in New York, a matching pair. And of course, New York and London are the financial capitals of the world. Really, the bankers of London, the city of London, and the bankers of Wall Street essentially play the tune to which the world must dance. So we've got these obelisks, which represent the phallus of Osiris, okay, in both London and New York. And ultimately, these gates for the temple of Baal, Set, Satan, will be erected in both of those cities as well. And Sharon said, this is like Ghostbusters. We've got the Keymasters, and now we've got the Gatekeeper. Like, oh, yeah. Well, that's interesting. Now, spiritually, supernaturally, what does this mean? To be honest with you, I don't really know. But I don't think it would hurt for us to pray that God would thwart whatever plans, that might be involved in this. As a friend of mine once said, look, if these fallen angels that misrepresent themselves as gods really need for us to do these certain things in order for them to have permission to work their whatever, then they're pretty lame. So I don't know if there's anything more than just symbolism involved here. But I think that's creepy enough. Now, there have been some stories out there, and I just want to touch on this for a moment or two, that say that April 19th is the first date of a 13-day series of ceremonies called the Blood Feast of Moloch, or the Blood Feast of Baal, and that there's human sacrifice involved in this, and there's some Illuminati Moloch cult that is behind all of this. And some of these articles have made it into fairly mainstream Christian publications anyway. And when I try to source the information for the existence of some special blood feast on April 19th and the 13-day festival leading up to Beltane on May 1st, I keep cycling back to the same source material. And I think the oldest claims that anyone can find date back to something that Tex Mars published in the 90s. But I can't find his source for the information. So I'm not convinced that this is a real deal, that there are some Christian authors out there who are, and I want to name names because I don't want this. This is not a personal me against them sort of thing. I'm just saying that I know that there are plenty of stories that there are a number of stories out there. Let me put it that way. A number of stories out there claiming that there's some blood sacrifice, human sacrifice that is behind this plan to erect the replicas of these gates in New York and London. And I just don't see any scholarly evidence that suggests there's anything special in the occult realm about April 19th. I'm not saying that this is harmless. I'm just saying, let's not sensationalize the story. Because when we sensationalize the story, we make it harder for the skeptics to accept the truth of the supernatural realm and the spiritual war in which they are deployed, whether they admit it or not. I mean, you know, me and you talking here, it's, you know, preaching to the choir. But if we're going to be take, And I know that most skeptics out there aren't going to take us seriously anyway. They already think I'm crazy for believing that the Bible is literally the word of God. But let's at least hold to the facts that we can document and not try to sensationalize the story beyond what we can document. I mean, yeah, there are already religious symbols sacred to the god Osiris in London and in New York that were taken from ancient Egypt, and now we're pairing them with the gate, a replica of the gate to a temple sacred to another, you know, false god, Baal, Set, Satan. That's disturbing enough. That's disturbing enough. If we start pairing this and saying, and by the way, this is all part of an Illuminati blood sacrifice, 13-day festival of evil, without any real evidence to back it up, then people will tend to discount even the stuff that we can document with hard evidence. So I'm just saying, let's you know, speak truth, but let's not embellish the truth. We can speculate. We speculate on this program all the time. Sharon and I speculate like crazy. But whenever we put it out in public, I hope that we are consistent in labeling it as such so that we don't mislead anybody. So a couple of other stories to touch on. I see that NASA is getting ready to have its impossible fuel-free rocket engine subjected to peer review. This is the EM drive or electromagnetic drive. They say they can power it with energy from the sun. It would bounce microwaves around inside a chamber and generate enough thrust to carry a spacecraft to Mars in 10 weeks. Now, peer review doesn't mean that the science actually works. There is a, and I should have done this again. Second time this week I've brought up this story and forgot to look up the numbers here. But there was a recent survey done of peer-reviewed articles that have appeared in journals over the past few years and found that fewer than half of the experiments that make it into peer-reviewed journals can be replicated. And that's, it just makes you go, what? I mean, how does it get peer review if these guys publish an experiment? I mean, the whole point of science is that you can replicate it to confirm the results. If you can't confirm it, why is it in a peer-reviewed journal? So just because the NASA EM drive is going to be subjected to peer review doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work. Although they have done a proof of concept, and it does appear that there's promise to this. So we shall see. But speaking of getting to outer space, physicists are a little concerned about attracting too much attention to ourselves, apparently. And they've designed a system to cloak the Earth from extraterrestrial eyes. One of the ways that we are able to detect a planet orbiting a faraway star is by watching fluctuations in the light that we receive here on Earth from that star. And if the fluctuations are occurring at regular intervals, we can assume that it's because the star is being occluded by a planet passing in between us and the star. So these physicists apparently believe that we can fire lasers into space along the plane. You know, you draw a line from the center of the sun through the center of the Earth and shoot a laser out into space in that direction so that the guys in Zeta Reticuli never know that there's an Earth passing in front of the sun. I don't think we have to worry about that, actually. But scientists need things to think about and debate and discuss. In fact, last week they had a discussion with a number of big-name thinkers. The panel moderated, or at least included, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's well-known even by us non-scientists. He was the host of the short-lived Fox reboot of the series Cosmos last year. A group of them on Tuesday night gathered at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, joined by Lisa Randall, theoretical physicist at Harvard, Max Tegmark, cosmologist at MIT, David Chalmers, professor of philosophy at New York University, Zohrat Davoudi, a theoretical physicist from MIT, and James Gates, theoretical physicist from the University of Maryland. Okay, these are not cranks. Mainstream, respected scientists. And the topic of their discussion was whether we live in a holographic simulation, a cosmic hologram. So they were asked, what is the likelihood that the universe is, in fact, a simulation? Mr. Tegmark said, or Dr. Tegmark said, 17%. Dr. Randall, theoretical physicist, said 0%. Dr. Chalmers, the professor of philosophy, I think had the most interesting answer and probably the most accurate answer. We're not going to get conclusive proof that we're not in a simulation because any proof would be simulated. We wouldn't know because if we're simulations and we're looking at simulated evidence, to us, it would appear real. Now, as Christians, we can look at this and just laugh and say, you know, this is foolishness. We have to address it because there are people being deceived and led into the new age by this idea. But as Christians, we know that we have been created to live in the natural realm, which is a subset of all of reality, because the supernatural realm is real. We can only perceive it when it chooses, or entities from it choose to interact with our reality. Someday we will perceive it in whole, now only in part. Interesting story from my file on the intelligence community. Became aware a couple of years ago when I started looking at the relationship between Facebook, social media in general, and the intelligence community of a venture capital division of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA. It's called InQtel. InQtel's mission is to invest money in companies that are developing technologies that will have relatively short-term, or rather, impact on the intelligence community and its mission in the short term, the near term, within 18 months. So you may wonder why the CIA then, through its venture capital arm, InQtel, is investing in a company with a line of cosmetic products that are marketed as a way to erase blemishes and soften skin. The company is called Skinsential Sciences, and InQtel has put money into the company because apparently in the process of developing these cosmetics, they've also developed a way to obtain DNA information from normal skin. I'm not quite sure how you get from point A to point B, but again, when it comes to InQtel, their money is put into companies that are going to generate some kind of payoff for the intelligence community within about 18 months. So, I mean, I don't know if they're doing some exfoliant type thing here or some sort of a skin peel, but for whatever reason, the CIA's venture capital firm, which doesn't give interviews, so we can't ask them why they think this is something that will be useful to the mission of the IC community. One other thing that I think is interesting that scientists have now shown proof of concept in the ability to store relatively complex images in DNA and then retrieve them again. So they've figured out how to convert binary data to DNA nucleotides and then convert those nucleotides back into images that we can perceive with the human eye. It is pretty remarkable because you can store apparently a lot more information on DNA than you can on flash drive, digital media. The problem is, of course, that the equipment to actually convert binary code into DNA strands is really, really expensive, which means it'll only be available to the intelligence community, at least in the short run. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, we're going to talk about space next week. Gil Broussard, It is long overdue in having Mr. Broussard on the program. People have been sending me email and links to his website and links to his interviews for months. And I've been really reluctant to get involved in the Planet X, Planet 9, Nibiru discussion. But I have talked with Doug Elwell about it a couple of times and his book, Planet X and the Sign of the Son of Man and the End of the Age. We've done two interviews about that book. And in the recent interview with Richard Shaw and Rabbi Mattatyahu Glazerson about the Torah codes, Nibiru keeps coming up. So, all right, we'll talk more about this next week. Gil has done a lot of research utilizing ancient astronomical observations from ancient China. Let me put it that way, and corroborating those observations with significant dates in history. Doug does the same in his book with certain events in history, and there are others who are looking at the skies and looking at the same sort of phenomena for to explain things like the parting of the Red Sea, the flood of Noah, of course, the distribution of the nations after the Tower of Babel. So anyway, Gil Broussard, our guest next week on A View from the Bunker. The Gilbert House Fellowship, our weekly Bible study. Sharon and I are finding that we're getting a lot out of that. In fact, probably more out of that than anything that we've been doing over the last 10 years, including this program, PID Radio, Skywatch TV. And I guess that's as it should be, because after all, the Bible is, you know, the Word of God. So we hope that you'll join us. We are going through the Bible in chronological order, which means that we're reading the scriptures in the order in the order of the events that they record. So that means now that we're into the time of David, because David shows up in Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and also the Psalms, we're skipping back and forth a lot. New Testament study does the same thing today. We did Matthew and Mark and then back to Matthew and looked at events side by side. It's really eye-opening. And today, our New Testament study in particular was really powerful. And that's no credit to me, no credit to Sharon. That's the Holy Spirit kind of opening our eyes and saying, here, pay attention to this verse. This is important stuff. So you'll find those studies going all the way back to the beginning. We've got 84 of them up there now. 82 of them up there now at gilberthouse.org. That's gilberthouse.org. This week on Skywatch TV, we talk with Gary Haven. Fascinating discussion with the writer and producer of the new film, Amerageddon, which opens May 13th around the country and will be available on DVD about 90 days later. It's a very stark, eye-opening warning about how unprepared we are in America for things to really go wrong. If an electromagnetic pulse were to knock out the electric grid and all of these electronics that we take for granted, a study commissioned by the United States Congress says that 90% of us would be dead within a year. We're so dependent on electric power, refrigeration, electricity to power water delivery. 90% of us dead in a year, and yet we're unprepared. Gary Haven talks about that this week on Skywatch TV. If you want a list of dates and times when you can see that program, you'll find the channel listing and time listing at skywatchtv.com. Look in the top menu bar there. There's links there in the top menu, the top bar, and the link says channel listing, and that'll take you to a list of channels, stations, networks, dates, and times where you can find Skywatch TV. We appreciate your review of A View from the Bunker, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to find this program. That helps helps it show up in the ratings, lets other people know that the program is out here and we're talking about stuff they can't find anywhere else. And of course, we've got a View from the Bunker page on Facebook. You'll find a link to that at vftb.net also. Click and give us a link, a like there as well. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. And we do this because we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.